morning.
Good morning. How are you? Good to see you. Wonderful. Okay, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Boys and girls. How are we all doing? Wonderful. Welcome to those who are here for the first time. Welcome to those who are here for the second, third, fourth, fifth, etc. Welcome those who are back. Welcome those who are visiting. Our general start, we do, it's called Parasha Under Pressure. We put really one pasuk under pressure to get a sense of what is glistening beneath the surface of what on the face of it seems like quite a simple, straightforward text, but actually can be filled with ambiguity and generate lots of different ideas, but also to give a little bit of an overview of the parasha before we start. Otherwise, we kind of get lost in the forest for the trees, or whichever way around. We're not getting the full arborist effect. So, what's this week's parasha? B'shalach, excellent. In the last couple of weeks, I've told you how, as I've recounted the parasha to my daughter at the Shabbos table, she has felt left in suspense and desperate to hear what happens next week. Because in Parashat Bo, you say you're in the middle of the third plague. The week before that, Va'era, you're in the middle of the seventh plague. You finish off, Moshe says, "Oh boy, Pharaoh, you don't know what's coming. Find out next week." And she said, "Oh, tell me what's happening. Just give me a little bit of what's happening next week." And then at the end of the next one, you say, "Oh," he says, "Oh, if you're careful, you know what's going to happen next week." But last week, Parsha Bo, if we're going all the way back, you got Shmos for Era Bo, it actually comes to an end. Not a happy end for the Egyptians. And in fact, at the behest of my wife, I did a somewhat a toned-down version of what takes place in the last few plagues. Darkness, you can always talk about. Although what I thought was drama and engaging, my wife said, was actually probably terrifying for a three-year-old, and maybe I should tone down how scary it was so it wasn't so bad. But, you know, you can't have everything. But it finishes, as we said last week, with the 10th plague, the wiping out of the firstborn, and then the release of the Jews, or at least the description of their release. We have the mitzvah of the firstborn. We have the mitzvah of tefillin mentioned. We have this description of Exodus. And you say, well, what happens next week? There is a lot of exciting things, but you have a natural pause. This week we have a very interesting moment. Perhaps the heart of the parasha is what? The crossing of the Red Sea, or the Sea of Reeds, as it's often called. And the Shira, the song. The first time we have a song. And in fact, the Medrash draws our attention to that fact, that there are times in history, in Jewish history, when you would have expected there to be celebration and song. Give me some moments of redemption in Jewish history, whether individual or national, that you would have expected celebration. The Akedah. You would have expected Avram to turn around after being told, you know what, don't kill your child, and say, you know what, time for some praise. I'll sing a song. When else? Noach, he gets off the teva, and there's this practice. They seem to bring korbanot, or set up an altar, but not quite celebrate. Seems to be, all right, let's mark this moment and move on. When else? You've got Noach surviving the flood. You've got Avram and his son surviving the Akedah. Yaakov and Yosef see each other. They cry on each other's shoulders, but there's no sense of God-directed praise. And in fact, the Medrash describes this moment and says God has been waiting for centuries for some sort of reaction. And they give description, the Medrash, to also the rabbinic legends, not just the biblical text, that Avram made it out of the fiery furnace, no song. That Yitzchak survived the Akedah, no song. Noach survives the flood, no song. Yosef gets out of the pit, no song. Yaakov meets his son, no song. They're waiting and waiting and waiting, and finally the Jews are free. So if we're going to take the rabbis at their word and engage rabbinic legend as well, that's true. Adam HaRishon, according to some rabbinic texts, sung the first song on Shabbat in praise of the Sabbath because he saw himself as saved by Shabbat. What was that song, according to tradition? Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbat, that we say every Friday night, Shabbos morning. But you have reminded me that I forgot that the Midrash also says that Adam was survived after the sin and he didn't sing a song. So you can ask the Medrash on each other, but it makes the point itself. Yeah.
He also got a
Shira. Who, Adam?
Yeah.
That's true. He didn't have to go very far either. He just had a nap and he got what he wanted. That's true. I can't remember. Maybe that's what it says, that Adam got a wife and he didn't sing a song. Maybe, I can't remember which one it was. But either way, he did well, despite the fact that he did the first sin with his wife. That's true. So the song is the heart and center of the parasha. And in fact, it's interesting. In England, the trop has a different tune than it does here. Who lay? Anybody laying here? Anyone know the tune? How does it go here? That's how it goes, right? Very tuneful. That could have just been me. Apologies. So in England, the practice has actually been to put it to a Sephardi tune. Anyone know Bendy Garmos? Spanish Portuguese, yeah. It's like a whole parade thing. Yeah, it's... Or was I singing just one cornetto? I don't know what I was singing, but either way, that it's kind of chirpy and exciting. Not, it doesn't feel like trap, it feels like song. Though there are different minhagim. Some only do the song for the psukim that had the name of God in, the name of Hashem, and some do it for the whole song. Either way, I don't know what they actually do in the Spanish and Portuguese. But we'll see. Either way, that's the song. But having said that, there are dramas, huge dramas, either side of that song. It's not that Jews were freed, and in this week we sing a song. They were freed. Hashem b'shalach bara et ha'am, that Pharaoh sent out the people. They went for a war. Kadosh Baruch Hu led them a specific way, not through the land of Plishtim, ki karovhu, because it was close. What's wrong with being close?
Nothing.
Right, you would have thought, I'll take the shorter route. Why is God taking him on the long route? To avoid what? Interesting. So you say to avoid war. It says he didn't want them to go to war and then want to turn back from the war. They end up in war by the end of this week's parasha either way. And Rabbi Sachs, I think his covenant conversation this week is about that. Maybe it was last year's. That they only go to war once they're through the sea and they can't go back. That's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu lets them go to war, when they can't go back. Which you would have thought as a slave, it's like, give me a break. You know, I just got freedom and now you've sealed off the way back and now I'm at war. But Rabbi Sachs has an interesting... piece about that. Either way, they're led along the path to avoid turning around. And while the entire people are in a sense of frenzy to embrace their emancipation, to run out of the land, there's only one person who turns around and remembers they've forgotten something. Who turns around because they forgot something? Moshe. What did they all forget? The bones of Yosef. Now, Moshe's given immense praise in the Midrashim and the commentators that everybody's looking around saying, what can I take with me? I'm going to take my iPad. I'm going to pinch that guy's 50-inch television. I'm going to take this bunch of gold. I've got to ransack the banks. And there's only one person who says, you know what? We as a people made an oath that we have to take Yosef's bones. Does that sound right to you, that disparity that Moshe's given praise and they're kind of castigated, the people?
Yes.
There you go. So we've got a support for that idea that Moshe is embraced by the sages for this act. In theory, I would have thought intuitively, one could be a little more easygoing on these slaves. After all, what has Moshe been doing for the last 40 years? Well, I don't know, I say vacation per se, but he's had an easy enough time. You would have thought he's been out in Midian, he's been shepherding sheep, he's been raising a family, he hasn't been whipped, he hasn't been beaten, he hasn't been forced into labor. He's lived a pretty happy life. So he gets to Egypt, and everybody's been enslaved. It doesn't shock me that Moshe's the one with the presence of mind to say, you know what, this isn't just about my freedom, I need to help with Yosef's bones. But there seems to be a harsh critique, and Eli's on the bandwagon, saying, well, you know what, fine, you've had a rough time, but don't forget your past. Don't forget your commitments. Don't forget your oath. You've made a promise. You've given a pledge. And actually, specifically at times of tension, of crisis, of challenge, when we are held to account for what we believe in. And that's what they should have done. So that's Moshe. There is a question as to, say again?
Were they even aware of the oath?
So this is an interesting question. Where was Yosef buried? Mitzrayim, that's true, big place. Anyone, I mean, if you told me, go to Mitzrayim and get Yosef's bones, I'd need more specific directions. Probably, possibly, it doesn't say in the text. And the Midrash, again, tries to fill in that gap. Where could he have been buried? And there are two views. One view was he was buried essentially in a pyramid with where royalty was buried. But again, they don't give you little signposts on the outside of the pyramids of who's buried where. You have to excavate, you have to dig, you have to find out. And there's another Midrash that says actually he was buried in an interesting place. At the bottom of the Nile. He was put in an iron cast casket and put in the Nile, and it went to the bottom. Now, that's a little harder to find than just going into a pyramid. So how did Moshe find Yosef's bones?
There was a paper with Hashem's name on it. Something like that.
Say again, he had paper with Hashem's name on it? And
it popped up.
Now, is this popping out of your head, or is this a memory that you've got? Is there any truth to that? I can't testify. There is some tradition to that.
Oh, okay.
So is this a memory, or this is like a lucky...
I just made it up.
All right, there you go. Excellent. I'm going to...
get the material for a waterproof casket coffin?
That's also a question. I mean, the Egyptians were an inventive lot. They came up with a lot of things. There is a Midrash, actually, that there was only one person who told Moshe where they were, which is Serach bat Asher. Anyone familiar with that name? Serach bat Asher. Anyone know how old she was?
Very.
Very. Good. Yes, correct. She was there with the group who came down and was still there at this point in the slavery. They'd been there 210 years. She was getting older in days. But there is this assumption in the Midrash that she... There's no proof she's still alive from the text. There's an assumption in the rabbinic imagination that Moshe needed someone who had eyewitnessed this moment to communicate the information. It couldn't be handed down on a piece of paper. It couldn't be given on a map, whether it's a Harry Potter Marauders map or a National Treasure on the back of the Constitution. There's no way to discover this. It has to be handed on by the person who saw it with their own eyes. And I don't want to, I'm going to try my best to avoid political rabbit holes, but sometimes it's helpful because it's in our minds either way to bring attention that sometimes seeing something with your own eyes makes a massive difference. And again, I'm not going to, the impeachment is over, at least for now. All right, maybe there'll be another one, but for now it's over. But the debate over witnesses, do people follow this out of interest?
Yeah.
Vaguely? All right. Did people try to run away from this and it followed them?
Yes.
Right, okay. So it's still following you. Is the debate over witnesses, it was a fascinating point because a number of the senators who said, I'm going to vote against witnesses said, some said, this is all unjust. It started unfair. We're not going to validate this process. And some said, no, I don't think you need witnesses because the point's been proven. Marco Rubio and others said, Lamar Alexander said, look, the case has been proven. What's the point of just more and more and more? There's a pile of evidence. We believe it. And we've made a judgment that it's not worthy of removal of office, but we don't need more witnesses. And the argument at that point from the other side could have been, all right, so why do you need more witnesses? But they didn't back down. They didn't say, we've convinced you. Why did they keep pushing? You could be somewhat cynical and say they wanted to make political hay out of it, which is possibly true. But it's also possible that seeing something with your own eyes, whether you know abstractly that something is the case, to see something with your own eyes makes a big difference. This was actually an argument given by some of the evangelical Christians in defense of pro-life arguments. They said, you can make as many pro-life arguments as you like. You can make it illegal. People are going to go to other states and figure it out. And there was a fellow in Connecticut, whose name I'm blanking on, William something, who said, let them see it. The best way to make sure people aren't doing willy-nilly abortions is to make a law that they have to look at the, is it called sonogram? At the sonogram before they do it. Because when they see it with their eyes, you know, abstractly, they're pregnant, they know that. But if you make them look at an image of a moving child inside them, it's going to make a lot of people not do it. Whether that's true or not is not neither here nor there. But the argument that seeing something with your own eyes communicates a very different message, and the Midrash is suggesting that it wouldn't have been enough to just have by hearsay, this is where Yosef buried. I need somebody who saw it to communicate the urgency of finding Yosef. So there is a Midrash that it was in the Nile, and Moshe threw something at the Nile, and the coffin floated up. So they may not have been able to find waterproof coffins, but they found sinking and then floating ones. The other view is that it was in a pyramid and somehow he negotiated his way in and found it. And either way, there Yosef was carried out with Moshe. The question, of course, why Yosef, when he made his brothers take an oath, he said, don't forget me down here when you guys leave. What alternative did he have? What could he have made them swear to do? Do it right now. Right? Yaakov didn't say, don't forget me when you leave. He said, bury me in Israel, please. Chesed v'emet, do me a favor. Yosef could have turned to his brothers and said, look, you think I'm angry with you. You think I've never forgiven you. You've never trusted my embrace of you. Do me this last favor. I promise you, the slate is clean. Take me back to Israel. They would. Why did he say, don't forget when you leave? What was this lying on his laurels almost? Why did Yosef want to be left in Egypt until they all left?
He was a prince, and they wouldn't have let him take them.
So there are some pragmatic readings, right, that he didn't want to bother them. Or actually, Yosef always had this ambiguous relationship with his brothers, and he didn't want to give them responsibilities. He didn't know whether he could trust they would fulfill. There was this doubt, this mistrust between them, and he said, you know what? When the air is cleared, when generations to come, this has been long forgotten, the tension between us, make sure I'm not forgotten. But I'm not going to give you a burden. Maybe you could view it skeptically and say, I'm not going to give you the benefit of the reward of taking me. I don't want to give you any honor in this. And maybe there was a mistrust. Maybe there was something hopeful that he wanted to be a source of inspiration for the Jews, which would negate the idea that he was buried somewhere at the bottom of a Nile. Maybe there was a mausoleum. To Joseph, the prince from Canaan. And the Jews all the way along for 210 years had this image of what it meant to be a Jew. They never forgot. They never truly saw themselves as a nation of slaves, but a nation of oppressed princes. And that gave them the hope that they would someday be free. Maybe that's why Yosef, and that's actually the Igros Moshe, where Moshe Feinstein has that suggestion. Now, we're told, yeah.
It also comes up that Moshe, it's the Mashiach ben David and it's Mashiach ben Yosef, from the line of Yosef, that with Yosef going up, it doesn't say where the other brothers are buried, and they obviously died in Mitzrayim during this whole term, and yet they're still there, or some of them at least.
So there's an excellent question.
And that leads into the whole idea of the line of...
Well, this is an interesting question. The eschatological issue about how do we get to Messiah is something we can leave for another time. But the question of they've taken out Yosef's bones, obviously, I say obviously, I hadn't really thought about it until just now. What about the other people who died in Egypt? Yosef was not the only... It wasn't like this was a small group that had been there for 10 minutes. You had generations of people. There must have been cemeteries filled with people who died, and they only took Yosef?
Especially since there's such an idea of the intensity and the importance of all of the Shvatim in
right.
subsequent years, and yet only he.
Well, there's a Jewish value, meaning there are conflicting ideologies here. On the one hand, we want to be as disassociated from Egypt as possible. On the other hand, we don't want to disturb the buried. Yosef made them take a particular oath. They had to fulfill to take him out. But, you know, there's a question, if anyone's ever been on any trips through Europe to look at the places where there was immense destruction, there are cemeteries. There aren't movements to disinter people and move them to Israel to get away because you don't want to disturb the dead. And you want to recognize where they suffered, where they were buried, where they died. And to some degree, Yosef is an exception. That there are... In this moment, people who are leaving behind loved ones in Egypt, and there is this difficult association. And that tension with Egypt never goes away. We have instructions, laws, never to return to Egypt. It haunts the rest of Tanakh, the relationship with Egypt. And I never quite thought about it in that context, that actually Yosef being taken out is just drawing attention to the fact of how many hundreds of thousands over two centuries must have been left behind. If we have a million leaving, that's a lot of people who have been buried and left behind. Okay. We're then told that they're taken through the Midbar, led by pillar of fire at night, pillar of cloud during the day, and they walked Yomam Valayla. Did they walk Yomam Valayla? How would you literally translate that phrase? They walked day and night. Did they walk day and night? What does that imply? What does that sound? Sound like no stopping. They kept moving. That sounds again. You just freed me. Let me have a breath, right? I want to sit down. Why are we still moving? In fact, there is another pasuk that has the exact same turn of phrase, Yomam Valaila. Which one am I thinking of? V'higita bo Yomam Valaila, the instruction given to Yahushua in the first chapter of Joshua, you shall delve into Torah. Yomam Valaila, day and night. Are we meant to be learning Torah 24/7, day and night? What's the instruction? Let's put it this way. What is the minimal reading of that day and night?
Some days and some nights. Maybe they rested.
Okay, so that right, that would be the most minimal reading, like meaning day and night. It's a turn of phrase. It means at day and at night, sometime you should do this. You shouldn't think this is only a daytime activity. You shouldn't think this is only a nighttime activity. Both daytime and nighttime is appropriate. There are some mitzvot that are only during the day. There are some that are only during the night. But Torah is not a nocturnal. What's the opposite of nocturnal? Diurnal activity. It is something that goes across the bounds of twilight. That's an interesting reading. The most minimal legalistic reading is the Vilna Gaon and others who say that Yomam Valaila means at day and at night. Once a day, once at night, you need to learn Torah. And in fact, you fulfill the essence of that verse by doing what? By saying Shema. You say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad in the morning. You say it at night, Yomam Valaila. I did it at day at night. However, there is a sense among some of the sages that actually our aspiration should be, there are pragmatic needs to relieve ourselves, to rest, to earn a living. But as far as we can, we should be filling our waking hours, whether day or night, with learning Torah. And in fact, there is a Gemara in Menachot, Tzaditet Amud Bet, which I'll remember for a reason I'll tell you in a minute, where one of the sages says to their mentor, can I learn Chachmat Yevanit? How would you translate Chachmat Yevanit? Greek wisdom. Greek wisdom. Can I learn Greek wisdom? And the answer is, sure you can, if Shalo Yom Velo Laila. If it's not day and not night. Meaning we've got to learn Torah Yom Velo Laila. So if you can find a time that isn't day and night, you're welcome to learn Greek wisdom. So of course, you've got some students saying, oh, Ben Hashmashot isn't day or night. So that's when you've got to learn secular studies during dusk hours and during sunrise. That's the moment you have to learn Greek studies. It's an interesting turn of phrase, and I remember when I was in high school and I was looking for yeshivas in Israel, the general feeling of the school was that it was a pretty broad spectrum of modern Orthodox Jews, again, pretty broad, you know, not in the human context, but in the Jewish context, and the teachers were all to the right, generally speaking, of where the students were. And the yeshivas were all to the right of where the students were, and they would send recruiting figures to come. And I had declared, but it was known that I wanted to go to Gush, which was not to the right of these places. And a number of rabbis would come and call me like the Gush boy and try to persuade me not to go. And it's a terrible thing for my neshama to go, and it's awful. And at one point, it's, you know, when you're young, part of you feels assaulted and part of you enjoys the fight about it. So I say, okay, so what's wrong with it? Let's have a sincere discussion about this. I feel confident in my decision. Again, I'm not deciding this to be rebellious. I've got mentors of mine who pointed me in this direction. It aligns with my life and my outlook. Why should I betray that to go to a place where I'm going to feel like I'm betraying my family values and what I believe to be right? And they said, well, you have to understand, Rav Lichtenstein, they said, who was at the time of the Rosh Yeshiva, is like Moses Mendelssohn, which number one told me he didn't understand who Rav Lichtenstein was or who Moses Mendelssohn was, but interesting. And then I said, what do you mean? Well, he says, the Gemara says you shouldn't learn Chochma Yevanit, you shouldn't learn Greek wisdom, which he translated as secular wisdom. And again, I was a 17, 18-year-old, so I was not familiar with the whole of Shas, as I am, of course, now. And I said, oh, that's a fascinating source. I'd not heard of that. I'd be interested to look at it. Where is it? Which was an excellent move on my part, because he then had to spend the next 3 hours trying to find it instead of taunting me, which was wonderful. And this was like right in the age before the Bar Ilan program and other things had become mainstream. And of course, in Gush, they were using the Bar Ilan program, so they had the advantage. And he's sitting there spending an hour and a half looking through the shas to find it. And he said, I think it, and he said, it's not in Brachos, it's not in Beitzah, it's not in Psachim. Okay, where is it? And he spent a long time trying to find it. And eventually, I actually Googled, you know, Talmud Greek Wisdom, and it popped up. It's in Menachot. And what was the article that it popped up in? An article written by Rav Lichtenstein about that sugya. So it's like, yeah, it's not like Rav Lichtenstein wasn't familiar with that. You know, different readings of what the problem with Greek wisdom is. Some actually say Chochmat Yevanit was not Greek wisdom as in philosophy, but Greek philology, meaning the study of the Greek language. The Greek language at the time of Chazal was a very intriguing thing. It was used by other faiths as their sacred text. And in fact, there are reports in the Talmud that the Bible, the Tanakh, is fitting for only two languages, Hebrew and Greek, which is astonishing. The Chumash was translated into Greek under some duress, according to which version of the story you see, by the sages themselves. Some of the greatest commentators of the age, Philo, our understanding is, never read the Chumash in Hebrew. Most of the Jews of the age were not fluent in Hebrew, read in Greek. So the question was, can I learn Greek language? Is that a valuable thing? They would say, no, you have to learn Torah. But it wasn't about secular wisdom generally. And there are different views of it. Either way, there is a reason we're talking about this, but it's not familiar to me anymore. Why are we talking about this?
Yom Valayla.
Thank you! Yom Valayla. So did they walk all day and all night? Were they doing Greek wisdom day and night? So there is a view, just like the Gra, that says they were walking day and night, means they were trying to make headway, but actually they were slaves. They were exhausted. They deserved rest. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want to say, okay, 9 to 5, we're walking, and then take a break. He'd say, 9 to 9:30, we're walking. Then you're going to break for 3 hours. And then at 12:30, you're going to walk for half an hour. And it was day and night, meaning they would walk for half an hour in increments across the day and night because God wanted them to make progress, but didn't want to push them. There is an alternative reading that says, no, literally, Yom Valayla, they walked day and night. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu made them walk day and night. And why would you do that? What impression does that give to Pharaoh?
The serious.
They're out of here, right? The slaves didn't just leave like, okay, we're out of Egyptian jurisdiction, let's sit for a moment. They said, we're not going to stop moving. And again, Pharaoh thinks, how long are they going for?
3 days.
It's not clear, but they've only ever asked him to go for 3 days. And if they don't stop moving, and they keep walking, and 3 days later, Pharaoh looks out, and they've walked a 6 day distance, there's starting to be some doubt about this, and that's actually what launches the pursuit of Pharaoh and the soldiers. And so there is a reading that they walked Yom Valayla day and night to stir up Pharaoh's mistrust, to get him to run, and this is all a setup, this is all a ploy to get the Egyptian army into the sea, which is exactly what happens next. Pharaoh and the army hear what's happening. They charge out to find the Jews. They get to the Red Sea. The Jews say, oh, lovely to see you. What do they say? For the first time of many, they turn to Moshe and say, what on earth have you done? I'd rather die there in Egypt than die here at the sea. Why have you made our lives miserable? And this is just the very beginning of a pattern where the Shira is an exception to the rule, where most of the time they're complaining. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, stop praying, protect the people. Tell the people to stand where they are and watch. This is a moment of passive national birth. They have to understand that this is not something they've achieved on their own. This is something I will wage a war for them. I will drown the Egyptians. The sea splits in a miraculous moment, we're told, from an east wind that blew it open. Depending again on which movie you see will depend on how you construct this moment. And not just movies, the commentators read this differently as to whether this was manipulated through natural events. If anybody saw, again, I mentioned Exodus, Gods and Kings, the most recent incarnation of these movies about 3 years ago, there, if you look very carefully, it looks like there's a massive asteroid in the distance that bashes somewhere out in the Mediterranean in the middle of the night. And then come the morning, there's this huge surge that pushes the water away and they cross and then it comes back and hits the Egyptians. Again, it's hard to claim that it was by chance, but perhaps it was through mechanical natural events. The Abarbanel has a similar view about the plagues, that they naturally led one to the other, like the frogs had died but didn't disappear. So what happens when you have a million frogs that die but don't disappear? they stink and they rot, which leads to lice, which leads to disease. So it was kind of a natural progression, which a number of the commentators resist because they want it to be as miraculous as possible. So there is no room for the Egyptians to turn around and say, oh, this is just nature. But there are views that it was all natural. Either way, Rabbi Sacks, I think a few years ago, Covenant Conversation this year, was about whether it was whether there was a BBC documentary he quotes that someone went out there to try and do studies to see if they could find a river that had gone back and forth, and they found a little brook, that there was some notion archaeologically that it had had some sort of effect. They said, well, it's hard to imagine 2 million people had an issue getting across. Anyone see Robin Hood Men in Tights? I can't swim. Help me, Robin. It's a puddle. Get out. Right? So it's hard to imagine that would have deserved a shearer or caused a problem. But that's where the BBC ended up. So who knows? Well, we know. Either way, so they get across the sea. There are the midrashim about the experience there. They were hungry. They could reach into the water, take out whatever they wanted. There's a midrash that there were fruit trees they were walking along. There's a midrash. There's a commentary, the Malbim actually suggests, because it says they walked across on dry land, that actually they walked across ice, that it had frozen the bottom. This is part of the idea that this was dealing with natural events, that this east wind, the way it worked was, it blew the sea open, and it was a cold wind that froze the water. That's how it stayed there. It wasn't like in the Ten Commandments where you got these fountains bursting up, but actually they walked through the equivalent of, I guess, what Elsa would have made in Frozen, this path that had been blown solid for them. I'd imagine be a little slippery, but either way, it was frozen flat. There's another view of Midrash that says, actually, the Jews were complaining at this moment because the bottom of the seabed, as you can imagine, is not that dry. And they felt like they were walking, kind of stamping in the mud. And some of them in their heads thought, what difference does this make? 2 months ago, I was in Egypt in the tar pits, and now I'm in a sand pit doing the same thing. How is this freedom? Which has been used, again, moralistically to say that context is everything, and to think only about the fact that I'm trudging here, not think about the broader context, that I'm on a journey to freedom, that I'm not being told to do this by a taskmaster, is a important fact. There's I've heard mentioned a couple of times something called missing tile syndrome. Anyone ever heard of this? There is research suggesting that if you walk into a tiled room and there's one tile missing, naturally our eye is drawn to that one spot to focus on what's missing as opposed to the tiles that are everywhere else. And this has been, psychologists have used to suggest that we are deeply wired to focus on what's missing, what's lacking, what we need, what is incomplete as opposed to the larger picture. And that's kind of what that midrash seems to be driving at. Yeah.
What you just said, looking at the larger picture, going back to the Imam Balila, why it was necessary is that the interpretation we've been using is that they were leaving Egypt. Okay? But then taking it in a forward, proactive perspective, they weren't leaving it, they were going towards. And therefore, the Imam Balila hastens it for them to get to the goal to which they were going, which is across and towards, and then having achieved that,
yeah,
it follows with the song.
Yeah, so it's interesting. There are a number of ways we can construe the psyche of the Jews at this time. Are they optimistic? Are they forward-looking? Are they trapped? Are they looking back? And again, the details of crossing the sea are not painted for us. So again, if you're making a movie, if you're painting a picture, if you're imagining in your head this moment, we have to fill in the details. And sometimes we don't, because when we don't have them, we just imagine, oh, crossing the sea, singing a song. But if I were to push you and say, what did it look like? Where was the water? You'd have to give me an answer. And the Rabbeinu Bachya has a very interesting reading that says, actually, when we say there were walls of water and the sea split, it wasn't like it split open and they could just walk through to the other side. There are some views that they were tunnels. And there are some views, the Rabbeinu Bachya says, actually, the water moved with them. The water was there, and it moved with them a step forward. There was never a single moment where they could see the other side, and the water was on them on each side. And it's an interesting moment where they have to push forward to get to the other side. They have to be optimistic and driven to make it. I've realized in our summary we haven't got very far yet, and we haven't got to our Pasuk. So let's drive forward. Egypt gets drowned. They sing the song, the Shira. And then after the song is done, we're told that one of the most important figures in the Jewish people, one of the three leaders, comes forward with a song. Miriam. Miriam comes forward with the women. She sings the same song. I asked Rabbi Soloveitchik if he had anything interesting on the Parsha a couple of days ago, and immediately he went into an opera by Handel about Jews crossing the sea, in which he didn't stop singing for 3 days, which was lovely, which at this moment has Miriam right at the end of the three-part opera come out and sing, "He has thrown the rider and the horse into the sea." That's what she sings at the very end. But she's introduced in an interesting way. It says, "Miriam Achot Aaron." Miriam, the sister of Aaron, brought out the women and sang a song. If you were, if I said, who's Miriam, how would you have described her? Moshe's sister, right? Or if you wanted to be a bit more genealogical or comprehensive, you would have said, Moshe and Aaron's sister. You may have said the daughter of Yocheved, the daughter of Amram. Why has the Torah at this moment, as they leave the sea, as she takes the leading role in garnering the women and singing a song and celebrating their freedom, as she introduced, Miriam Achot Aaron, Miriam the sister of Aaron?
Playing the same role that Aaron does.
Go on.
Bringing people together.
Oh, fascinating, fascinating. I've not seen that, so that's why I ask you, so you can get some interesting ideas, that maybe she's playing that role that Aaron is known for, that he is Rodev Shalom, he seeks peace, and what Miriam is doing actually, and putting it in that way makes it sound like maybe the women were feeling uninspired at this moment. We've made it through, the men have got it out, and they're feeling a little like, I don't know how to deal with this moment of freedom. And Miriam garners the women to come together. They're like, we don't have a leader. Moshe's standing there. He's a powerful figure. The men feel strong. Finally, they've been unleashed. And in some ways, the realm that the women occupied at the time was the being in charge of the homes. They had power, right? The women are given the credit for our freedom in some ways, for our continuity, for keeping the family strong. And now they're trying to figure out their role in a new world. And Miriam Achot Aaron comes up to bring the people together. That's a fascinating idea. There are some technical suggestions that actually we want all three to be mentioned in the context of Az Yashir, and Az Yashir Moshe, and we've got Miriam, and we want Aaron to get a mention in the context of the song too, so it's Achot Aaron. There's actually the Netziv suggests that Miriam wasn't quite as prophetic as Moshe. So it says, Miriam Achot Aaron. You should understand that her activity here was in an Aaron style, which meant it wasn't quite as prophetic as Moshe, which seems a bit of a dampener, but there are views like that. But the Midrash actually says, why Achot Aaron? To say that in some ways, I don't know if superior is the right word, but certainly precedent, she is higher than Moshe. Because how long has Moshe been speaking with God? Since when? When was the first contact Moshe had with God? The burning bush. How old was he, roughly? 80-ish, right? Meaning he'd had 40 years of Mitzrayim, roughly, we assume 40 years of Midian, he gets contacted by God. How long had Miriam been hearing from God?
Since he was born.
Since who was born?
Moshe.
Since Moshe was born? What happened when Moshe was born?
He's put into the basket.
Not before that? When? Right. So there's a midrash that Miriam came to her parents who had decided to separate because they said, I can't bring children into this world, which is not an unreasonable statement to say in the midst of slavery. And Miriam says to her father, what does she say? You're worse than Pharaoh. You're worse than Pharaoh because Pharaoh's put a decree on the boys and you've just said there'll be no girls either. So she really comes forward as a hero for women. And she had a prophecy to say, if you have a child, that child will redeem us. So she's called Achot Aaron. Aaron's older than her. Meaning she's been prophesying before Moshe was a sparkle in her parents' eye, right? Before Moshe came anywhere near God. 80, 90 years before God had contacted Moshe, Miriam had been in contact. She was called Achot Aaron to draw attention to the fact that she'd been doing this for years. And she was a figure of hope before Moshe came on the scene. Yes, this is Moshe's moment. Az Yashir, Moshe Ben Israel, he leads the people. But Miriam comes out after that song in a sense of deference. She didn't run to the front and say, me, me, me. She had Moshe lead the song. But then she comes out, the woman who had been there, Achot Aaron, since the moment Aaron was around, has been prophesying and hoping and inspiring and driving the people to build their own future. And this is her moment to come forward. So she's described as Achot Aaron. They then wander in the desert for 3 days. There's no water. They get a little thirsty. They start to complain and they say, oh, in Egypt, we were sitting by Sir Basar. What is Sir Basar?
A
pots of meat, flesh pots. That is a term that, as a young kid, I remember the rabbi in my shul using that term all the time. I had no idea what it meant, what he's talking about. He would, again, rabbis take different roles in different shuls. Sometimes they take the chastisement role. It doesn't always get well received. And I remember that there would be a lot of people in the shul. In England, it's much easier to go to Israel than from here. It's quicker. There's no time delay. It's cheap, all sorts of things. People go to Eilat for the winter all the time. Said, "Ah, oh, welcome back to the flesh pots of Eilat." And they like, ha, ha, ha. They didn't like it. I didn't know what flesh pots meant. Say again.
It's a derogatory term.
That's what I got, but more than that I didn't get. And then I saw the translation of the word sir basar in one of the older translations as the flesh pots of Egypt. I'm like, oh, that must be the origin of that derogatory phrase. They were sitting by pots of meat. Now, there, when I was in Chicago, I gave a parsha shiur occasionally, usually once a week. And there was a figure every year who would come up to me and say, the slavery in Egypt wasn't so bad. Slavery in Egypt wasn't so bad. Look at how it's described. Described that they had houses. They could go back to their families. What do they complain about when they get to the desert? They say, why have you brought us out to the desert? We were sitting there with pots of meat. If we think about the horrors of the 1940s, it's unimaginable that people would get out of there and think, oh, it was better in the camps. I can't imagine a single place or context in human history on anywhere on planet Earth where anyone would have that comment, it was better in the camps. There was no food. You were separated from family. Your time was not your own. You were not given clothes. You were not given medical care. You were stripped of your identity, your sense of self. And here we have Jews coming out from Mitzrayim, which for us is the founding moment of surviving trauma, that we repeat memory year after year after year at the Seder. Talk about from suffering to freedom. And they're saying, we had meat, we had drink, we had security, we had time. Yeah, it wasn't great. Technically, we were owned by the Egyptians, but it's better than this. And the commentators are struck by, well, hold on a minute, how traumatic was Egypt? If they're sitting here saying, we had meat, it was better in Egypt, how bad could it have been? And I remember actually talking of Gush, Rav Amital, survivor, would occasionally say that it's not clear to him that Mitzrayim was worse than the Shoah. Again, I'm not a historian, and nor am I in a position to make comment on either. But how it does seem strange that the Egyptian experience is contextualized in a way where people are complaining, we had meat. How would you resolve this issue? Other than saying, yeah, maybe it wasn't so bad. Maybe this is about political autonomy. Maybe this is about freedom nationally, not about personal trauma. I mean, how do we describe on Pesach? We describe Avodah Kasha. We talk about Avodah Befarech. This was traumatic. There are Midrashim that, well, number one, they threw the children in the Nile. That wasn't so easy, right? The Midrashim paint a picture where they would go around slicing up children. The women had to give birth in the fields so that they wouldn't discover the children, and they had to leave them in the fields. And there are Midrashim that say that some miraculous behavior managed to bring these children up. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that there is this Midrashic idea that the children were birthed in the field and then somehow absorbed underground and gestated there. And then the Egyptians would come with plows to the field because they'd seen the women give birth and doubted them. And then the children survived somehow. And that's the bracha, malach ha-goleti, v'yidgal ha-rov, bekerev ha-aretz, that they will multiply in the midst of the, meaning literally, in the land. And at the beginning of Shmos, when it says, v'yirbu ma'od ma'od, bekerev ha-aretz, it's the same phrase, that they multiplied with it. There are descriptions of this being harrowing. Why are they complaining we had lots of meat? So, yeah. Oh. Okay, interesting. Stockholm Syndrome. Again, I'm not a psychiatrist. I only actually know Stockholm Syndrome from a James Bond movie. I don't remember which one it was, but there's one where someone has Stockholm Syndrome according to the plot. She falls in love with her captor and then ends up trying to kill James Bond. Say again? Who's that?
They coined it. She was kidnapped. Patty Hearst. She was heir to the Hearst.
Oh, yes. There you go.
She wants, yes.
Right, so Stockholm Syndrome essentially is you fall in love with your captor through all sorts of psychological reasons. You end up being grateful, dependent, you draw an attachment. It's a way of projecting and surviving the trauma, whatever it is. You grow an attachment and you actually cannot cope with being freed from that relationship and you develop a dependence. And this is described not just when you're kidnapped, but also in abusive relationships. This can occur. And here you've got the Jews saying, we want to go back, we want to go back, we want to go back. Maybe there's a, on a kind of broad level, one could talk about Stockholm syndrome. Yeah.
Psychologically, they're up against, they're in a terrible situation at Yamsu. And all of a sudden, so they forget how bad it was. And, you know, their mind is just telling them, oh, it wasn't so bad. Now it's bad. We never should have left. It's basic human nature.
So meaning they did have meat or they didn't have meat?
I don't think it matters. They're
how do you imagine it?
Parts,
I think it's an interesting observation. And in fact, one of the commentaries suggests that this is invented on their part. And again, I don't want to draw broad profiles of what it's like to endure poverty, but the commentator says this is how people who are in poverty behave. They'll knock on your door and they'll say, please help me. And you'll give them $5 and they'll say, oh, well, the guy down the road gave me 500. The guy closed the door in their face. But they're desperate. And you invent tales that would make other people be more favorable to you in order to survive. And the Jews are here with Moshe saying, we had meat. Of course they didn't have meat. It was horrific. We've just described the traumas. They turn to Moshe and they say, well, this is all we get. In Egypt, we had this. They're desperate. So as you say, it doesn't matter. Of course, they didn't have all that in Egypt. But the truth or falsity of that statement is not what's important for the psychological profile of this moment. It's the desperation to invent and almost try to manipulate Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please give us more. We had all this in Egypt. Give me now. That's a view of one commentator. Another view actually is that this was the Shoatrim that were complaining. The guys who were running the discipline over the Jews, they got treated pretty well. And they're sitting here now while the rest of the people have nothing to say. Why do they have nothing to say? Because they're fine. They're free. They're not complaining. They say, yeah, this is much better. And the truth is, I'd rather die now than be enslaved for the rest of my life. But you got these Shoatrim who say, I'd rather have died in Egypt in my position of power and influence and freedom, relatively speaking, than be trapped here and die in the desert. I had it pretty good there. I had the leftover meat. I had a good treatment. I had authority and power and a level of dignity, or at least false dignity. And now I'm going to die in the Midbar. And it's like a small group of people complaining, the Shoatrim, the Orach Chaim says this. Everybody else was quiet because they were pretty happy. We're nearly at our pasuk. Yeah.
Maybe it has something to do not with psychological profile. By human nature, people don't like transition. Whether it's even if they know it's going to be better or it's going to be lighter, humans are routinized. I mean, you know, now when you take them out, you have to deal with the unknown in the transitional process. And it's about transition, not so much about ultimate goal.
Yeah, that's. I think we mentioned in the past 1 week from Shawshank Redemption that they're being institutionalized means that transition is incredibly hard and coping with a new form of life. In fact, when talking of Noah, when the flood is over, there's an interesting grammatical turn of phrase. It says, "Vahotzei or vahotzi Noach habehemot min hateva," and Noah took all the animals out and. The grammatical form of the word hotzi, Rashi says, is hifel, causative. He calls them to leave. And the question, why do you have to cause animals to leave? They've been cooped up for 40 days in a tight space without room to roam, without food, without freedom, without seeing sunlight. The doors open and Noach is, and he has to get the stick out to get them out. And I remember actually we did a yearbook in high school. They do that here? Yearbook in high school. So there was a yearbook committee, which I don't know if the word is pro forma, I had to be on because of a position I was in the student body at school, but I wasn't that involved with, and I had to write like an opening letter at the front to say I wish you all well. Anyone read Harry Potter? I was head boy. I don't know if that means anything to anybody. I was not in league with Voldemort or the Ministry of Magic, if that helped. But so I had to write a parting letter to the school. And I mentioned this, that, you know, after, and I thought it was particularly apt considering my high school experience, that we'd been cooped up in a kind of animal zoo for 7 years. And now we're all transitioning into a new position. And there is a reluctance, whether it's the J.M. Barrie Neverland sense that I don't want to grow up, or just I'm used to life. I know the building, I know the people, I know my place, I know how to manipulate my life in this system, I know what to expect, I know my routine, and now everything's changing. And please God, it should be for good. But I don't know how to cope with that transition. And the Jews are here saying, we were sitting next to the pots of meat, and the truth is, they don't say we ate meat. What do they say? We were sitting next to pots of meat. What could that situation have been? Maybe they were being forced to cook for the Egyptians. They think, but at least we got to smell it. At least I knew my place. At least I knew how things worked. And now what am I doing? I'm just in a desert of uncertainty. I've got a sea behind me. I've got an army rushing at me. And at least there, I was sitting next to pots of meat. I could smell beauty, even if I couldn't live it, right? Maybe that's exactly what it is. Transition is hard. And this entire moment is about getting through the sea and shutting it off. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Aviva Zornberg, who's got an interesting three books, maybe four out on the Chumash, actually Tanakh more broadly, suggests that this is literally the breaking of waters to go through the sea. This is a moment of birth. And babies come out crying. They're not happy. They were in the womb. They were in complete darkness. It's still strikes me as very weird that they weren't breathing for 9 months. But it's good. They're about to get all the love they can imagine, hopefully. But transition is hard. And the Bnei Israel are crying and they're shrieking and they're forced through and the sea is shut off behind them. There is no going back. It wasn't just about drowning the Egyptians. There is this whole momentum in the beginning of the parasha. They're being driven in the long route so they don't go back. They're being taken through a sea so they physically can't go back. There is a need, like Noah, to push them out. And actually, I remember when the yearbook came out, you don't usually expect sincere feedback from high school guys. You expect them not even to read that page, but to look for the funny pictures of the teachers that we put through the book. But one of them came up to me and said, I found that really helpful. It is a difficult moment, and I was really moved by that. And I remember that 15 years later, because I was so surprised, number one, that anyone read it, and number two, that it resonated. I haven't spoken to them in about 14 years, it stuck with me. Okay, there's more in the parasha, but we should at least look for 3 minutes at the pasuk that we were going to do. There's a whole episode with the man, and of course, one of the most memorable moments that we've forgotten to mention, the end, what happens at the end? Amalek attacks us. Moshe's hand become kvedim. They become heavy. There are all sorts of things to talk about, but you know what? Please God, next year. So, and behold, and it was, when Pharaoh sent out the people, God did not lead the people through the land of the Philistines because it was too close. Now, the opening few words sound like they're just reminding us, context setting, meaning last week we all went free, and it was when Pharaoh freed the people, this is what God did. Now, when's the next Rosh Chodesh? Where are we up to? Anybody know? The date. Tu B'Shvat's Monday. Okay? We're not near Rosh Chodesh. We're closer to one that just went by. Every Rosh Chodesh, every Chag, we sing Halal. What is the second paragraph of Halal? Apparently, the song version I grew up with is not universal. I thought it was. And then I was with my in-laws one Shabbos. They asked me to do Shacharis, and I led, but say to Mitzrayim. And it's one of those awkward moments where it's the Chaz, and you start singing. You're committed. You've got to keep going. And nobody knows the tune. And you're like, okay, I didn't think this was going to be a solo. Not your treat, but what can you do? But yeah, they're so different. But Seis Yisrael Mei Mitzrayim, which translates loosely or tightly as when Israel left Egypt. Why isn't this parashas but Seis? But Seis Yisrael Mei Mitzrayim, v'lo nachamu lokim derech plishtim. Who are we crediting with our freedom? And it was when the magnanimous Pharaoh sent the people on their freedom. He sounds like a hero. When Pharaoh released the Jews, Why on earth is he getting screen time? Why are we putting his name out there? Why are we associating him with our liberty? It should be Vayehi, but say Israel, me Mitzrayim. Forget Pharaoh. We're done with Pharaoh. He's no longer of interest to us. We have been released of him. I don't want to hear his name again. That's the question the commentators wonder in these opening words. Why is it Bashalach? Why are we crediting Pharaoh with our liberty? Now, the first source, we're going to rush through this very quickly. The Ketav Kabbalah says, well, actually, it's not to give him credit, but to show, give God credit. That God said at the start to Moshe, trust me, Pharaoh will let them go. I'm not going to have to drag them out without telling him. Pharaoh will release them. And it's impossible to imagine at that moment that someone so... I'm trying to think of the when you're entrenched in the ground, you've put your dug in. That's the word I'm looking for. You're so dug in. I don't even know where that metaphor's from. That must be a sport of some sort. But he's so dug in to his position, they're not going free. He's been through 10 plagues. With each passing plague, on the one hand, it becomes more likely that he's worn down, but also becomes the less likely he's going to give in. He's come this far, and he's not going to stop. And God says, he will. Vahiba Shalach, and this is the testament, God gets his way. Pharaoh sent them free. God wins the war. Pharaoh has lost. That's the Ketav Kabbalah. The Malbim actually has an interesting view. It says, how long were the Jews meant to be in Egypt? Anyone remember how long the oath was to Avram? 400 years. How long were they there? 210. Either God is not good at math or not good at predicting, it seems. What do we do with that? How could they come so early? How could they leave? Say again?
You dance around it.
Okay, one way is to dance around it. Legal loophole. This is the first moment where Hashem says, let's be lawyers here. That's true, which we'll get to. One understanding is that they had been so harsh to the Jews, 400 years worth of trauma was compacted into 210. So it was legitimate to walk away. But God has still given his word. He's still given a prophetic oath that it will be 400 years.
What's the timing in this story?
400 years started from the time
of the oath. So there's another way. Again, this is not God as a loophole. This is us as readers looking for a loophole. Say, when does the 400 years begin? So one way is from the Brit Ben HaPetarim. It is troubling because in a few psukim time, it will say they were down there for 400 years. So we've got to find a way around it. One version, the Malbim here, of course, the greatest Jew that ever lived, says that it was too harsh, they could come away. But God had still put his name to 400 years. He couldn't just come in and say, right, Jews, let's go. He had to have Pharaoh send them out. Legally, he's saying, I have no right to drag you out of here. I've given my word. Again, I know we're free of impeachment. I don't know how many people watched yesterday on Tenterhooks about which way this would go. But if there was a moment of surprise yesterday, which at least to me there was, but there was someone who broke ranks with the party and gave a speech. Mitt Romney gave a speech. And however one feels about him, the process, which way it should have gone, it was an astounding moment to see a figure who, it seems on the face of it, has no real incentive, and at least from the way he presented it, no personal incentive to break from his party and go with his conscience. And actually his speech, it was odd to watch. It's only about 8 minutes long. There was a figure who got a lot of, screen time, who got name dropped a lot. Whose name got mentioned a lot? Yeah. It was not Trump. It was God.
He claimed he was a religious person, and that's why he did this, because of his religion.
And a moral responsibility.
It's interesting. He played very hard. I don't know if play is the right word. He leaned very hard on the religion. He began by saying, I'm a very religious person, and 2 weeks ago I took an oath before God. At which point he got a little choked up and couldn't really speak for a while, and then got back to it and said, I took an oath before God and I take religion very seriously. And I have no choice but to follow my conscience and conviction here on this point. And he said, I'm not judging and saying that nobody else is doing this. I assume, he says, I know the other senators, I'm close with them, and I presume they're doing the same thing, I presume. And again, that could have been a little bit what we could call overgenerous, but on either side. But he's saying, I presume everybody takes their oath seriously. But he made the point and said that if I've made an oath, how can I expose my character to the censure of my own conscience by not holding by my oath. And here the Malbim is saying that actually you're right. We give Pharaoh more credit than he deserves. We have his name here. I wish, Malbim says, we could have started with Seis Yisrael Mi Mitzrayim. But circumstances forced Hashem's hand by his own volition to say, I've made an oath 400 years. My word is me. My integrity is me. And obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can do anything, but he's modeling for human beings that when we make an oath, if we give a commitment, we follow through. And if that means I have to give Pharaoh some line credit here to make that message, I'm going to do it. Pharaoh sent them out because legally I couldn't do it. I had to wait another 190 years to do it. Pharaoh had to send them out. And the importance of being attentive to our language. And I learn this daily because often my kids come up probably far too frequently in these presentations. But they occupy a lot of my mental space a lot of the time, so you'll have to forgive me. But there are incentives all the time for me to just make stuff up. Oh, if you do this, I'll get you that. If you do that, and kids remember. And if you don't get stuff for them, they think, oh, well, number one, it becomes less effective as an incentive because they don't believe you anymore. But it also means that they see that words aren't that important. That what you say doesn't necessarily bind you. That commitments, that promises, that pledges aren't that important. So luckily we've now invested in a little star book so we can keep track of who gets what and when they get it. So I don't have to be worrying about me offering things that I can't provide. But that's the Malbim on this. He's got more to say on that. But we're going to wrap up because we've gone too long. It's also worth pointing out that first word of the parasha. Good or bad? Vayehi, for Chazal, is an intimation of doom. Vayehi, b'mei Achashverosh, is the classical location where they say, Vayehi loshen sar. When it says, it could say haya. Vayehi, again, in terms of its pronunciation for the sages, is vayehi, which even if you don't speak Yiddish, oy vay, vay is an onomatopoeic term for trauma. Why? Even in English, it's nearly like that. Why? Right? And vayehi is an intimation that there's something terrible on the horizon. So the Or HaChaim and others say, I don't understand. This is the moment of freedom and you're in trauma. And one view is, not by him, by others, just vayehi b'shalach paro. Yeah, the trauma is that Pharaoh had to send them out. That they couldn't, either you can... There's a view that, well, Israel should have been more proactive. They should have said, we're leaving. We're not going to sit around for this. Why did we have to wait around for Pharaoh? But I guess if you embrace the Malbim view, that it's just tragic that we had to rely on this. And it's a shame that we had to begin with Pharaoh, but legally we had to. The Rachaim suggests actually the tragic is everything that happens in this parasha. What's about to happen? Why did Pharaoh send the Jews out? According to the Rachaim, Pharaoh sent them out so that he felt like he was in control. So that 3 days later, when he hears the Jews aren't coming back, he thinks, I let them go. I'm still within my rights. I still have power to get them back, right? If God had just swept them out, he thinks, I'm done. I've got no power here. But if he was the one who said, fine, I will let you leave, and they couldn't leave before that, he could be under the impression, I still got authority. I don't know who this God is. I don't know how he works, but he seems to think that my jurisdiction is important. Otherwise, why is he asking me all the time? Just take him out. So I sent them out. I'm going to go get him, which, of course, was part of the ploy to get them to follow them into the Midbar, to get into the sea and to wipe them all out. And the Or HaChaim says that's the Vayehi, that a huge number of people are about to die. And sometimes the freedom comes at the cost of life. And it's necessary and it's important, but it's also tragic. And Vayehi is a way of saying we're about to sing in joy about the death of thousands of people. But from on high, this isn't a happy, purely happy moment. That moment will come later. This is a moment of tragedy, which of course is the Midrash that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. When the angels start singing and God says, right, my creatures are drowning in the sea. Why are you singing? Of course, the Jews were singing, but they had undergone their liberty, and they're entitled to that sense of relief. Angels, you're fine. Don't just sing because people are dying. When are you going to sing? You sing at Har Sinai. when they become a people, when they get a destiny, when they have a mission, when they come together. Right now, this is about a necessary freedom, and people are dying, and Vayihi, it's a sad moment. The Mechilta...
That's also supported at the end of in the Hallel, in the subsequent days of Pesach.
So that's an interesting point, that half Hallel is sung for the second half of Pesach. Why is that the case? There are a number of different readings of that. One is that you only really need a whole Hallel when there's a new Korban that day. And Sukkot, there were different korbanot every day, so you have a whole halal. Pesach, it's the same korban every day, so you have a half halal because it's a minhag more than a necessity. There are different views, but there is a late midrash. It's one of those things that it's worth talking about another time. It so captivated us as aligned with the Jewish ideology that it's almost as if it's halach l'moshe mi-Sinai, that we were told only half halal, second day is Pesach. But it's actually relatively late. It's about 15th century is the first intimations that maybe that's why. Not suggesting it's less legitimate, just historical context is interesting. Again, in the 13th century, when you're being pogromed and persecuted, saying, oh, well, we shouldn't be happy when these people die. It's hard to imagine people writing that reflexively and passing it around. Like, don't be angry when these people die. They couldn't dream for anything more than their neighbors who were slaughtering their families dying. But when you get to a moment of freedom in Italy or towards Jewish emancipation and in America, the American Haggadah that was put out for the Jewish armed forces, the American army, has themes along those lines. That have been kind of gathered kind of from bits and pieces from moments of Jewish history. Perhaps the most famous, I'm spoiling something I could talk about Pesach, but I'm hoping that people have tuned out by this late in the shir and that we'll all forget, is that what is the moment, the ritual, which in the middle of the Seder we do to commemorate the loss of the Egyptians? We take wine out. Everyone familiar with that? Mm-hmm. Everyone says that every year when somebody asks. The first notion that we take wine out because we don't want to fully celebrate the Egyptian death. The first time that appears in text that we can find is about 1900. And if you look at the medieval sources, there are suggestions, why do we take out with the plague? Dam, Sfardea, is because what we're saying is, the medieval writers are saying, you think Dam was bad? It was just a drop in the bucket of what's coming for you. But you think Sfardea was bad? It's a drop of the wrath that's going to pour down on our enemies. Which, again, in 1900, when Jews are suddenly embraced in America and we're trying to build bridges and show that we are not racist, xenophobic, insular, but we're actually interested in the global human family. We want you all to die is a little hard. Let's try different reading, which, again, is not to manipulate the masses, but just to align with our experience. How do I stand up? I remember when Saddam through my childhood, when you stand up and you open the door and you say, may God spit on everybody and hate everybody. For a lot of people at the Seder, it's a difficult moment. Like I feel like guilty saying this. But for a lot of Jewish history, it was probably quite easy to say that. Either way, we've gone over time. We're talking about Pesach. We haven't hit Tu B'Shvat yet. So we'll get there. I wish you a good Shabbos, and we'll meet again next week.